Welcome to episode 432 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I have a solo episode where the format is coaching thoughts, which is something that readers of the Scientific Triathlon newsletter are probably quite familiar with. And for long-time listeners, it is similar to what I did back in the TTS Thursday series, where I picked one particular topic and discussed it in some depth. It's not exactly the same, though, because in that context, I was quite structured and ordered, having episodes dedicated to swim, bike, and run training, then strength training, racecraft, nutrition, and so on. Whereas my intention with the coaching thoughts episodes like this would be more to tackle any particular topic that I have for some reason been thinking about recently, big or small, without any particular order or context to the other episodes. So normally it would be things that I've recently had discussions with athletes or other coaches about, or things that I've observed in my group of athletes, or for that matter in my own training. And this means that these topics are often quite contextual, for example, contextual to a certain type of athlete that I'm working with. And I will, of course, explain that for each topic, but I do want to make it really clear that a lot of these topics I bring up are, I bring them up as food for thought that may or may not be applicable to you, as especially when we're dealing with the finer details of training, the nuances rather than the big picture stuff, there is nothing that is universally applicable. It always depends on the context. But I'll do my best to explain this as well as possible for each particular topic, and you be the judge of how that works. I'm definitely keen to hear your feedback on how you enjoy this episode format. But before we get into the meat of this episode, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. And they have just come out with an exciting new announcement that they are the official hydration partner of the 2024 Ironman and Ironman 7.3 European Series races, including the World Championships in Nice. Athletes with questions about nailing their race nutrition strategy at Ironman European Series events can book a free video consultation with the athlete support team at Precision Fuel and Hydration, or you can use the free race hydration and nutrition planner on their website, where details about each specific Ironman European Series event has been added and included in the planner, which is awesome. And as a listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. The great thing about the Senate is that it is so versatile, so you can make it work to suit your swim-specific needs. For a lot of athletes, the primary need may be to work on technique, which the Senate does, but for others, it might be to improve force and power, and the Senate can really help you with that as well. They have a great library of video-guided workouts, so you can pick and choose from to find the ones that best suit your particular needs. And you can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, before diving into the main topics for today, I'd also just quickly like to ask that if you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, help the podcast grow. And if you can, leave a 5-star rating and review in Spotify or Apple Podcasts, that would be even better. These things really go a long way to helping the podcast keep growing and ultimately keep it sustainable and keep coming out on a regular basis. So thank you very much for your help with spreading the word if you choose to do so. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the main topics for today's episode. So the first topic that I want to talk about is the distribution of training across swimming, cycling, and running from a return of investment perspective. So let's start here with some caveats. Of course, everything always depends, but what does it depend on? So in this case, when we're looking at where do you get the biggest ROI in terms of how you distribute your swim, bike, and run training, it depends on things like your strengths and weaknesses in these disciplines, your athletic age in triathlon and in the three disciplines specifically. It depends on your robustness and your injury risk profile and on your time available to train, on your goals for and the demands of the race that you're training for, your general goals in the sport, and a bunch of other things. But let's, for argument's sake here, say that you're a fairly experienced athlete. You're pretty even across swim, bike, and run. You train at a moderate volume, let's say 10 to 12 hours per week. And you're quite robust and haven't had any soft tissue overuse injuries or bone stress injuries in the last few years. In this case, this particular coaching thought is that for an athlete that is quite evenly strong in the three disciplines, is not already doing huge running volume and have proven themselves to not be prone to injuries. In many cases, I think that running is the discipline that offers the highest return on investment of the three disciplines. If you, for example, find yourself with an additional hour or two per week to train, or you're maybe just examining how you're currently distributing your training hours and wondering whether you should make any changes to that distribution. So now, to be clear, I am not saying this in any way as a hard and fast rule. This is just a thought to consider in your own context. I have considered it in the context of many athletes that I coach, and I find that there are quite a few cases where it holds true, but there are definitely cases where it does not. So the main examples of when it maybe does not hold true is when an athlete is susceptible to running injuries. Obviously, then you generally don't get a higher return on investment by focusing more on the running side of things. You get the opposite generally, because it typically ends up in injury, so you shouldn't go down that path. And the second case where I think that it probably doesn't hold up is that you have athletes that are much stronger runners than they are cyclists, for example. And well, in those two disciplines in particular, I would say in that case, obviously you need to do some work on the bike to even out the disciplines. But coming back to the example of the evenly matched athlete with strong robustness to injuries, why then do I think that running often offers the best ROI for this type of athlete? Compared to the swim, you can definitely find some good improvement in swimming, just like you can in running, by, for example, adding an hour of training. But with the swim being the shortest segment of the triathlon, even a good improvement in swimming in relative terms, in percentage terms, for example, doesn't really translate to a lot of time out on the race course. So that's the first reason that the swim offers less ROI. But I also think that in swimming, let's say that you go from 2 hours per week of training to three, or you go from 3 hours per week to four, you will clearly see improvements for a while, but I just have the experience that you come to more of a ceiling of here but no further in terms of how much you can improve your swimming compared to your running. So maybe the first year of adding or having added 1 hour per week of swimming, your improvements might be similar to the ones that you would see running. But then after a while, maybe in the second year, that's where I think that a lot of people can keep improving their run, just with having added that 1 hour per week of training, for example, but they might have already stagnated with the swim, because even at, let's say, 4 hours per week of swimming, it's still a pretty small amount considering that we're trying to do a foreign movement in a foreign medium. So I just think that there's a much higher ceiling for how far you can take your running with a similar amount of focus between when comparing those two particular disciplines. Now, if you compare running to cycling, I think the issue here is that cycling works on a different timescale in some ways than running. So as a triathlete, on a standardized triathlon program, you're likely to bike around twice as much as you run in terms of hours, to be pretty evenly strong across the two disciplines. And that can be measured by, for example, taking your results per each discipline in a race and see where you stack up in terms of a percentile result in your age group, or perhaps in the overall field. But in a bigger race, you can take your age group and see that, okay, I'm in the 50th percentile for my bike and for my run fairly evenly. So if you see that as a pattern in across many races, then you know that, yeah, you can be considered an evenly strong cyclist and runner within a triathlon context. But yeah, anyway, so as a triathlete, you are likely to bike around twice as much as you run. And if you start from scratch with triathlon and you run and bike the exact same number of hours, let's say you bike and run 4 hours in each discipline per week, you will most likely find yourself becoming a much stronger runner than a cyclist in triathlon context, because the running volume is pretty good, but the cycling volume is pretty low compared to what the top athletes in your age group are probably doing. So I think a main reason for this is that in running, even easy running, even very easy running, is in a way hard. It's hard on the body. It's also harder, I would say, in terms of the percentage of VO2 max that you're using when running easy compared to cycling easy. You can even look at things like how many hours a year do world-class runners train versus world-class cyclists. So the training volume of world-class runners is typically around 500 to 700 hours per year for the top marathoners and 400 to 600 hours per year for track runners, focusing on things like the 5K and the 10K. Many of you listening might even train the same amount for, or even more, in terms of yearly hours for triathlon training. In cycling, however, you're looking at generally 900 plus hours per year of training, and there are definitely some cyclists that would be a lot higher than that. There is more variation in cycling than in running, depending on the cyclist profile and so on. But either way, it's fair to say that on average, the volume required for world-class performance in cycling is at least 1.5 times that of world-class performance in distance running. So basically, this is a long-winded way of saying that I think that going from 3 hours to 4 hours of running, for example, is a relatively big jump towards quote-unquote best practice, and therefore can have a big impact, whereas going from 6 to 7 hours per week of cycling is, of course, still extremely positive and over the long term should have a big positive impact, but I don't think it just moves the needle quite as much as adding that 1 hour to running, just because the percentage increase towards quote-unquote optimal is smaller than in the case of running. So now, if for some reason you are running 5 hours per week and you're cycling 3 hours per week, of course, I would say then that the balance is off and you have much more to gain by reallocating some time from the run to the bike. But I'm coming at this from a point of an athlete that is evenly strong in cycling and running, and they have a balanced triathlon program, which might mean that you're, let's say, running 3 hours and cycling 6 hours, so you have that roughly 50% of cycling volume is spent as is your time spent running. Another perspective we can take here is to look at a physics perspective, and on the bike, the power improvement that you have to make, all else being equal, to go from, let's say, 30 to 31 kilometers an hour is much less than the power improvement to go from 40 to 41 kilometers an hour. So the faster you get, basically, the less you get out of any improvement in power in terms of speed, and speed is what matters. Running is done at way slower speeds, so we don't have the same issue there. You don't have anywhere near those issues. You basically don't need to consider aerodynamics as a factor in running for most age groupers. If you're doing a sub 2 hour marathon attempt, then yes, you do need to consider that, but that's a different story. Swimming is also a slow sport, but it is done in a medium that is about 800 times denser than air, which means that any given improvement in swimming power will result in a very small improvement in speed, which I'm sure we have all felt in training or racing when it feels like we're pushing harder and harder and exponentially increasing the effort, but the speed stays almost the same. So in that sense, swimming is more akin to cycling in that a pretty large improvement in power can potentially result in a pretty small improvement in speed, whereas in running, it's more like a linear relationship there, that you get fitter, you get faster to a similar degree. And a final point that I would make about why the ROI of run training is good is that it is so time efficient. So we all know why the swim with commuting to the pool, etc., is not very time efficient, not to mention the fact that in a 25 meter, let alone 25 yard pool, the amount of times you're actually turning and not training specifically for the demands of open water swimming, which is consistent, continuous, taking strokes, it's not specific because of the micro breaks that you get. I'm not saying that it it is a huge issue by any stretch, but it does reduce the efficiency slightly of pool swimming when for the demands of open water swimming. A 50-meter pool, if you have that available, is of course way better, but you still have some losses of efficiency just with the turns. That is a minor detail, to be fair. Don't take that as too seriously, but it's just another small inefficiency that you have in swim training. With cycling, depending on your situation, you might have some distance of inefficient city riding before you can start actually properly training, plus the time to get your gear in order and get dressed and all of that. And especially in winter time, it all adds up to quite a lot. Then we have the argument that the indoor trainer is a super efficient and effective tool. And it is, just purely from a power perspective, it is super effective. But it also should not be underemphasized just how common it is for athletes to do all or most of their training on the indoor trainer. And then they go outdoors and either cannot translate the power from indoor riding to outdoor riding, or cannot translate the power into actual speed. Or the third thing that can happen is that you might be able to do that on a flat non-technical course, but just lead time on more technical courses. So obviously this is not the case for everybody. So I'm not saying for a lot of people, the indoor trainer or you can do the majority of training on the indoor trainer and not suffer from these issues. But it is a case for a lot of amateur athletes, I would say, that the indoor trainer is effective in improving power, especially on the indoor trainer. But whether it's effective for riding faster on the race course, it really depends on a lot of things. So for sure, the indoor trainer can be a reasonably big part of riding faster on the race course if it helps you improve power, which it can very easily, and probably translating that power to outdoor riding is pretty easily done for most people. But if the indoor trainer is the whole plan, then there is a group of people that is not going to work so well for because of those differences and those points of inefficiencies or potential inefficiencies. Running, however, is very simple. You just get dressed, get out the door, and you can run almost no matter where you are. There's practically no dead time. There's no commuting time and no having to get out of the city. It's all very specific as well. Nothing is sort of lost in translation the way it can be between pool to open water swimming or between riding indoors to riding outdoors. So in terms of using your calendar time effectively, let's say you have 95 minutes available in your calendar, you might easily get in a 90-minute run in that time, or let's say 85 minutes if you also account for a shower afterwards. But in that same time, you could do a 45-minute swim or a 60-minute ride, if we're talking about an outdoor ride here, and how much of that is effective riding time is another question. So obviously, there are counter-arguments for all of these points I made here. I'm not claiming to provide any sort of proof that running is or offers a superior ROI. But to me, I'm more thinking about my anecdotal experience, and I do include myself in the category that I think I benefit from focusing more on running. But more importantly, this is experience from quite a few athletes that I coach or have coached in the past, where I've seen it really work quite well to potentially reduce bike or swim volume a bit and add that volume to the running bucket instead, without any loss in swim or bike performance, but with significant improvements in run performance. So I think that this is something that I have observed as a potential pattern in when you have certain constraints that are fulfilled and certain parameters that I've listed out at the top of this segment. Much more commonly, I think that this holds true and with greater effects than compared to, for example, shifting the emphasis towards swimming or towards cycling in an athlete that is pretty evenly strong across all three. So what is my take-home message here? It is simply for you to consider how you allocate your training time between the disciplines, and if you would be better off taking some time from the swim or the bike and allocate it to the run. Be smart about it. If you're not confident in your robustness, then this is not the way to go at all. But I think for a certain segment of athletes, especially if you feel like your race performances have stagnated a bit, this might be an interesting solution to consider, or potential solution to to try out. And it is also something that I don't think gets talked about so much. We do hear a lot about how well cycling translates to running, and that if you're not running well off the bike in a triathlon, it could be because you're not strong enough on the bike. And that's not incorrect at all, but I also think that sometimes the pendulum almost swings too much in favor of talking a lot about the bike and how important it is, or even the swim, and the running gets underappreciated sometimes. So the run is basically an area that is very trainable in the context of amateur triathletes anyway, and it does require consistent work and consistent kilometers or miles, but the actual time you need to put in is nothing crazy to get those consistent improvements, especially compared to biking and swimming, and especially when we look at actual calendar time and not just active training time. So food for thought there, and I hope that you enjoyed that segment. Now, segment number two here, or coaching thought number two, is hills, and we're continuing on the theme of running. I am continuously amazed by the power of using hills in run training to elicit performance improvements, and I feel that there is still an underappreciation for them from most athletes and coaches, myself included. There's definitely nothing new at all about hills. It's basically a tale as old as time in run training, with Lydiard being one of the most well-known, but certainly not the first protagonists. We have examples like Renato Canova uses hills in a large variety of ways, and East African runners in general are famous for using a lot of hills in their run training. And I think the reason that hills have come to be underappreciated, maybe more so among triathletes, to be fair, than among runners even, is because in this day and age, we are a bit fixated on being able to measure everything and having very exact pace targets, and that's often not possible with hills, although you can easily do it if you always use the same hill for the same type of workout with some clear landmarks as your start and stop points. Then the stopwatch is your measurement, and you can't fool the stopwatch. It's basically the cold hard truth. But anyway, I also speak for myself here, because I know that some of my best running fitness has come when I have been doing weekly long hill reps in addition to a lot of general aerobic running on hills. But even knowing this, I find myself doing or tending to get to the track or to the flat roads and for my harder workouts, and closely targeting and monitoring my paces. And this is, as a bit of a side note, a great example of why even coaches should have coaches. I do not at the moment, but it's not that I don't know that I benefit from hills. I do know it, but I fail to be objective about it. I let myself think that for some reason, for me, it's really important to run specific paces, even though I see in so many athletes that I coach that hills are oftentimes way better than tracks if you want to actually improve your run. So from this personal experience as an athlete, I fully get why people opt out of hills, because you want to see yourself hitting those faster paces. But I just think that as a coach, my advice would be for you to consider using hills and use them quite a lot in your run training. It does go for bike training as well, by the way. And we discussed that a bit in the last episode two episodes ago, I should say, with Mel McQuaid. But that's not the topic of today's discussion. So, coming back to, why should you use, what are the positives of using hills in run training? To me, in my opinion, the main ones are that, first of all, you have an increased mechanical work requirement of running uphill, and it needs to be met by increased muscular activity. So you basically force your muscles and your joints to work harder. And the second one being that you do that while having less impact stress due to the lower speeds. So you have lower risk of injury. Although there are certain muscles that are heavily engaged that you need to be a bit careful with, like the hamstrings. So it might depend a little bit on what kind of propensity for injuries you might have. To give one example, I think it's a really nice example of an athlete that I coach who quite recently had a breakthrough Olympic distance run. It was a 32:44 10K, a full length 10K on a very hilly course. And in a build up to that race, every single one of his harder run sessions, except I think one session in taper week, was some kind of hill session. So it was either a continuous hilly tempo run, which ranged from 8 kilometers to 14 kilometers of continuous tempo work, or it was hill reps that were usually 2 to 4 minutes long, and those were usually done on the treadmill. And because all of the work was so hilly, the speeds that this athlete was running in training were always 4 minutes per kilometer or slower, 4 minutes per kilometer being 6 minutes, 26 seconds per mile, even in those hard runs at 10K and 5K efforts in some of those hill rep sessions. But it was done on steep gradients. So for example, those hill rep sessions was on 6% grades. But then in the race, which also was quite hilly, that is a 32-44 10K, which translates to 3:16 kilometer pace or 5:16 mile pace. So as I said, this was a huge breakthrough race, and it just shows a great example of how hills just gives you the ability to really, really be strong, run strong, and running strong is often the same as running fast, because 3:16 pace, 5:16 pace per mile is not super fast. It's compared to a sprinting speed, it's not that fast at all. So it's more about having the strength to maintain a fairly high pace for a long, long time, and that's really where hills shine and come into their own. So obviously, I'm not saying that you should only do hills, because in this example, there are quite specific circumstances that led us to do it, with the race course also being so hilly. But it does show that you don't necessarily have to train at high speeds to run at high speeds. The strength and muscular capacity you build up by running hills can really help bring out some really good speed in you. So especially if you're stuck in a bit of a rut in your running, this is something that I would recommend experimenting with. So to help you get started, there are four types of hill runs that I usually would prescribe to my athletes. The first one is simple hill sprints. So these I would tend to prescribe as part of an easy endurance run, and typically towards the end of a 45-minute run or 1 hour run, 4 to 6 times 8 second sprints up a moderate to steep gradient. Do not explode out of the blocks. Take a couple of steps, 2, 3, 4 steps to build up to full power and speed, just to reduce injury risk, but then maintain that max effort for 5 or so seconds, and then slowly walk back down and take a standing recovery so you have at least a full minute's rest between hill reps. This is a great session for running biomechanics, for muscle recruitment, and for top-end speed, and it doesn't take a lot out of you because you're spending very, very little time running at high speeds. The second type of hill run is continuous hilly quality runs. So typically the intensity here would be somewhere between LT1 to tempo, so high zone 2 to zone 3, depending on a bit on the athlete needs and the event that they are training for. But I do like a hilly tempo run because you don't have to make it super long to get in a really good training stimulus. Basically, with a tempo run, I would prescribe it as aiming for an RPE of 6 out of 10 or around marathon effort or thereabouts, but that depends on how fast a runner you are. If you're a very fast marathoner, it would be more like an effort of, it would be slower than marathon effort and or easier than marathon effort. And if you're a slower marathon runner, then it would be maybe more like closer to half marathon effort. So the RPE of 6 out of 10, I think, is a more universal scale that anybody can use regardless of speed. In terms of elevation, I'd like to look for at least 10 meters of elevation gain per kilometer of running as an average in a run like this, but higher, like 15 meters or 20 meters per kilometer would be even better. And the distance, it really depends on where you're starting from, but I think that, yeah, you can start with a 6 kilometer, and depends on your speed as well, but starting with something like a 25 minute run or 20 minute run, and then trying to build up to 40-45 minutes of hilly tempo running, that would be a pretty normal progression that is suitable for a fairly broad group of runners and triathletes. The third type of session that I would prescribe is hill reps. as I said in the example above. So these might be 2 to 8 minutes long and either outdoors or on a treadmill. The treadmill can definitely be a good tool for this particular workout because it makes it a bit more dense. So you can, for example, have 4 minutes hard uphill running and then 2 minutes easy flat jog as recovery. Instead of if you go hard uphill and then you jog easy downhill, you're typically going at a similar speed uphill and downhill. So you end up having 4 minutes recovery for 4 minutes of hard running. So the treadmill can be a good tool here to make the workout a bit quicker and more dense. But be careful because in some cases, especially long hill reps on the treadmill seem to be a bit more, or some people seem to be a bit more prone to get niggles from that than compared to running uphill outdoors. Intensity for these sessions is very much tailored to the athlete needs and event demands, but I would use intensities all the way from 7.3 race effort to 5K race effort. And the grade I would use would typically be 5 to 6% on the treadmill, or if outdoors, I would just prescribe something that feels like a moderate grade, not too flat, not too steep. Basically, use what you had, don't overthink it. But to give you an example of a session here from the example athlete that I just talked about, with the focus on sprint and Olympic distance racing, was a 20-minute easy warm-up. And then the main set on a 6% grade, except the recovery is at 0% grade. 5 sets of 4 minutes at 10K effort, 2 minutes easy, followed by 2 minutes at 5K effort, 2 minutes easy. So that is a 10-minute total repeated 5 times through, so it's 50 minutes, which includes 30 minutes of hard running. And then after that, finishing off with 4 by 30 seconds at mile effort, so not quite an all-out sprint, but a very hard effort with 1.5 minutes easy jog or standing rest, basically to simulate the finishing sprint of a race. And the final and fourth type of hilly run that I would prescribe is to do base endurance runs on hilly terrain. Again, looking for something like 10 meters of elevation gain per 10 kilometers of per 1 kilometer of running is a good starting point. If it's even hillier, then that can be even better. But just make sure that you don't run too hard, neither uphill nor downhill. If it's a base endurance run, keep the effort easy. You're still getting in that strength work on the hills. So it's all good, even without pushing the effort. Now, to help you get started with introducing hill running into your training, I would say take a period of 6 weeks as a trial period where you replace half of your general endurance runs with hilly endurance runs, or hilly endurance runs with hill sprints, 4 times 8 seconds, 6 times 8 seconds, as I described as the first type of session. And also replace half of your harder runs. You might be doing 1 per week or 2 per week, but either way, replace half of them with an equivalent hilly hilly option of the workout that you're doing. So if it's a continuous tempo run, make it a hilly continuous tempo run. If it's an interval workout, make it a hill rep workout. And just give it a try and see if you think it makes a difference. And I think that if you're in the habit of doing mostly flat or flat-ish running, then you're quite likely to see a boost in performance just from this simple change of introducing some hills to your running. The one downside here that I should point out as well and talk about is that depending on where you live, your ability to do hill runs might be limited. Most people, even if you live in a very flat area, can find some kind of bridge or a parking garage or something where you can do shorter intervals. But anything longer, like the longer tempo runs, can be impossible to do outdoors if you live in a flat area, or even longer hill reps, like 5 minute hill reps, 4 minute hill reps, unless you use a treadmill. And I'm not somebody to recommend running on the treadmill. If it's something that you really dislike doing and you prefer being outdoors, that is fine. Then you just have to maybe make do with doing some shorter hill sprints and potentially some really short intervals with what you have and what you can find. And maybe make use of time when you're away to do a lot more hill work. But if you don't dislike running on the treadmill, then it might be worth it to do one run per week on the treadmill to get a really good hill session in. I think that there is a lot of value in that from a return on investment perspective, again, in terms of running performance. But yeah, that it really depends on your attitude around and how much you like simply or dislike running on the treadmill. So if you dislike it, just take a something is better than nothing approach and do what you can on whatever very short hills that you can find outdoors. So to finish off here, the take-home message is simple. Hills pay the bills. So, okay, if you're an amateur athlete, they probably don't pay the bills. But the point of that saying that has been used by coaches and athletes for decades, and I really do agree with the sentiment, is that using hills within your running is very good general advice for improving as a runner. So give it a try and see how it works for you. Okay, and now my final coaching thought for this week's episode is about choosing the right goal distances and goal events. There are a couple of points here that I, again, would just like to raise for a conversation point, not trying to give any right or wrong answers here because I don't think they exist, but it's just to get everybody thinking and maybe generate some discussion. So as a starting point, I think that there is a tendency in endurance sports to think that shorter distances and events are somehow inferior to longer distances, or that they are just stepping stones towards longer distances. This is very similar in triathlon and in running as well. It's almost assumed in running, for example, that your main goal is always to run a marathon or even an ultramarathon. And in triathlon, the thinking goes that you do sprint and Olympic distance races either because you're new to triathlon, so that you're still building up to half and full distance racing, or you're doing it casually or in preparation for your main goal, which is of course a half or a full distance race. And I think that as a triathlon community, we have to stop thinking in this way because it's neither healthy for us personally nor for the sport as a whole. For the sport as a whole, I think it's unhealthy because it means that we exclude people who might be very interested in doing triathlon but have no interest in doing long triathlons like half and full distance races. And there is that, because there is that obsession with and focus on longer distances, they might not even be aware that triathlon is not the same as Ironman and Ironman distance racing. So that's a big problem for triathlon as a sport. And I also think that it's a problem because we're creating a large group of people that are, let's call it one and done athletes. So people that want to do an Ironman as a bucket list thing, and they do one, but they do it once and then they're out of the sport because it's simply too much for them to consider staying in the sport. Understandably, because triathlon is already an extreme hobby in terms of time commitment, but it's especially so when training for something like an Ironman, and it doesn't have to be as bad as that. It doesn't have to be anywhere near as much as that. So I think we have to find a way to be more inclusive and prevent the large amount of churn that we have in the sport due to this one and done mentality. And not just the one and done, but also just people burning out a bit, which I'll get to in a minute. If we care about the future of our sport, then this is something we should think about. And I didn't even mention costs yet, but this is another big factor that makes long distance triathlon very exclusive. Not just the race entry fees, but also the extra need for equipment, possibly a TT bike, coaching, nutrition products, wetsuits. You can do most sprint or many sprint distance races without a wetsuit, even if the water is not too warm, but because it's only a 750 meter swim, so you can get through that without a wetsuit. But yeah, there's just so much equipment costs that goes into racing longer distances that you can definitely save a lot on by doing shorter distances and get away with not spending a ton of money on triathlon. And so that's from the perspective of what's healthy and unhealthy for the sport. And on an individual level, I think the mentality of thinking that it's all about long distance can be unhealthy for several reasons. So number one is that it can very easily lead to burnout, whether it's physical or mental or both. And especially for newer athletes who don't have the support of a coach or a club with teammates who have been there and done that and can help and give advice. And reason number two is that it can easily be less enjoyable and more stressful than you would like a hobby to be, especially in busy periods of life, such as with small kids or during busy career-focused periods. And this is something that I see a lot as a coach when, let's say, people have kids, for example, and decide to stop doing triathlon altogether, when in reality, it isn't that time-consuming to just do a few sprint distance races here and there. You don't need to train a lot for that. And I'm not saying that you need to have a coach or anything for that, but just stay in the sport even during times that are normally busy rather than leave the sport completely, I think, is an option or could be an option if we consider other distances than just the long ones. And reason number three is that it can be less healthy than what a normally very healthy sport should be. For example, the main reason that I think that long-distance triathlon can be unhealthy sometimes is when you have athletes that are very busy. So again, you're coming back to point number two a bit, it can be very stressful. Stress is not healthy, or excessive stress is not healthy, I should say. But the other point is sleep. There is definitely there is a cohort of athletes that skip sleep to have time to train for an Ironman and or making similar compromises, and that's not healthy. So there is a healthier way to do the sport in these cases if you don't have the time and you end up skipping on sleep, for example. And number four is that from a social perspective, it can have a negative impact on your relationships if you're always training for an Ironman or a long distance race, and all of your free time goes to that. So I just want to be super clear that I'm absolutely not saying that it's bad to train for long distance triathlon and you shouldn't do it, because I love it and I think it's great. But what I'm saying is that some people will be better off focusing on shorter races or even periodizing their focus a bit. So for example, doing an Ironman once every 2 years as their longest race, and in between those years, maybe the 7.3 could be the longest distance, but then sprinkle in a good amount of sprint distance and maybe Olympic distance races liberally through that, and that could free up so much mental and physical burnout and stress and in for many athletes, I believe. So let's not just look at the push reasons, the reasons that are pushing, that should push some people away from a single-minded focus on long-distance triathlon, but let's look at some positive pull reasons that should pull people towards racing more shorter distances. So number one is that it can help you to become a better, more well-rounded athlete. And this can very often translate to better Ironman or 7.3 performances when you return to those distances, as you might improve your skills, your speed, your VO2 max, etc., when you focus on the shorter distances. So I think that for a big group of athletes actually who have been stuck in an Ironman cycle of racing 2 to 3 Ironmans per year for the last few years and very little in terms of other racing, it is actually very, very likely that you will, in fact, become a better athlete. Also, later on, when returning to the Ironman distance, if you spend some time away from that distance and focus on something like sprint distance racing. Reason number two to move towards shorter distance races or include them more in your racing calendar is that it allows you to race a lot more, which in itself is fun. It's a reward and a positive, but it also allows you to better develop general race craft and again become a better athlete that way. Number three is if you do have the option to race draft legal racing, it is like a whole new sport opens up to you with a different bike, different race dynamics. And this doesn't place in too many places, unfortunately, but it does in some places, including, for example, Portugal and Spain, as a very common format of racing. And in some countries, I know that the national championships for the sprint distance tend to be draft legal. For example, Finland, at least to my knowledge, a few years back it was, because I participated 1 year. And I also believe that the US national championships for the sprint distance are draft legal also at the amateur level, or at least they have been. So it may exist in a whole lot of other countries as well that I'm not aware of off the top of my head. So check out if you have the option in any race around you where you live to race draft legal. And if you do, I would really encourage you to give it a go, because it's such a different and very, very enjoyable experience. Reason number four to choose to race shorter distances is that it allows you to race with no or low pressure, especially early on when you haven't done it in a long time or you haven't done it at all. So a lot of people in triathlon are very driven, very type A, always looking to improve on PBs and qualify for worlds, things like that. But if you go to a new race distance and a new race format that you're not familiar with on different courses, maybe different competitors than you're used to, then this means that you don't have any outcome measures to hold yourself to, so you cannot put the same pressure of achieving a certain outcome on yourself that you might normally do when you're racing a very familiar distance, possibly on the same race course year in, year out. And of course, ideally, you shouldn't race with that kind of negative outcome pressure holding yourself to time goals, etc. Anyway, but it's easier said than done sometimes, and sometimes just changing distances, which basically forces you to do so and go in a bit blind, can be a real positive in terms of taking some pressure off, especially for the very driven, very type A personalities, I think. And reason number five is, again, coming back to how good it is for the sport as a whole to have a thriving short distance racing scene. When you're choosing to race in that arena, you're supporting the growth of the sport as a whole by supporting grassroots events that are more inclusive and accessible to more people. And hopefully down the line, this could lead to a virtuous cycle with more and more race options opening up as the sport grows and thrives across all distances and across multiple race organizations. Another thing that I want to mention is that as I'm planning this episode, we are a few days after Ironman Texas, and there is once again a lot of talk about big pelotons of athletes riding together in what nominally is and should be a non-draft race, but in practice is anything but. And there is a lot of frustration about this, naturally, because it seems like for most athletes, there's nowhere to go. There are simply too many athletes on the race course. And sure, there are some people that choose intentionally to draft and could choose not to, but I'm pretty sure the majority of athletes are trying their best, but when there's just too many athletes on a limited distance of road, there's not a lot of options, and situations like this are almost always going to arise in these massive races, with especially with multiple loop courses. So if you have had negative experiences like this, then don't let it force your view on the sport to be negative and give up on the sport, but find events where that won't happen. So in a race with 250 people instead of 2,500 people, you are very unlikely to have a similar situation to that. Yes, you might have drafting, but it is one or two people potentially in a group. It's not whole pelotons riding by. And this is regardless of distance. You can find more grassroots half and full distance events, or it might be that you choose to try your hand at draft legal or non-draft sprint or Olympic. So no matter the distance, this new and sometimes more rewarding experience of racing with smaller fields, fewer athletes, it means that you're avoiding that frustration that you might have experienced in massive races. And you're also helping out independent race organizers, which, as I said, I think is good for the sport as a whole. It keeps these independent race organizers going as well and makes sure that we keep the sport open and accessible. And this is nothing against Ironman or other big organizations, because I am generally a big fan, although there are, of course, things that I think that they could do better. But it's not meant to push people away from doing Ironmans, but it's just to remind you that there are also other options, and they can be just as fun, interesting, and rewarding to do. So you don't have to look just at the Ironman page as your only source of potential races to do. And then a final point that I want to make is that I've mostly been talking about adding in shorter race distances to mix up your racing calendar, but there are also other things that I would say can help prevent some of those potential downsides I talked about before, for example, like mental burnout, even physical burnout, or just focusing for too long on and too much on long distance races. And these things can be to race non-standard events. So as an example, something that I'm quite keen on maybe doing one day would be the Alpe d'Huez triathlon. So okay, this is still very much a long distance triathlon, but it is a very different format. So this could be an option for somebody that wants to add something different than the typical race that you would do. And even though physically it will be just as hard, mentally both doing it and training for it could potentially be completely different than what you're more used to. Another similar example would be extreme triathlons like the Norseman. And another thing completely different from triathlon would be to, well, not completely different, but you could mix up different multi-sport options, like doing duathlons, swim runs, aquathlons, winter triathlons, and so on. So that can also be a way to mix up your racing calendar and get out of a rut if you're in one. And yet another suggestion is to try an off-road triathlon, for example, an Xterra, instead of on-road triathlons, if that's what you're typically doing. So these are all just examples of things that you can do to help spice up your racing calendar and your routine and help you keep things fresh, and will likely have a positive impact on you, both mentally and in terms of you really enjoying and loving your hobby for for many, many years to come, but also to improve you as an athlete, generally speaking. And this can help you in your, even in races like a typical full distance or half distance race that you may be more used to doing. And that might be your normal A goal for the season. But I think that adding these different things can also help with that. As a personal anecdote, I just a couple of days ago raced a draft legal sprint distance race for the first time in a few years, actually. And I had so much fun that I'm now at the moment thinking of committing my entire next year to just sprint distance racing, maybe the odd Olympic there. Obviously, I don't need to take a decision. I won't make a decision on that in a long time yet because we're early in this year and I'm focusing on this year. But, and I have to say that I still love the longer races as well. But in terms of doing something new, by doing something new, I found a renewed enthusiasm and appreciation for the sport that maybe I had lost a little bit in my own racing, not in my coaching, but in my own racing and my own practice of the sport. So I do want to say as well that that is not at all the trigger for bringing this topic into this particular episode, because I had written most of this whole script way before doing that race. So my personal anecdote is just a late addition and by no means the trigger for it, because this is just something that I see in a lot of athletes in general, in the triathlon community, in some cases in athletes that I coach or have coached. So both close and both from close up and from afar. But to summarize this point, both as a community of multi-sport athletes, triathletes and other multi-sport, and as individuals, I think there is a value in not always looking at our sport from a very narrow lens of long distance triathlon, but being open to fresh new challenges, such as racing different distances, different formats, different terrains, such as off-road triathlons, or different sports altogether, such as swim run or the other multi-sports. Full and half distance triathlon races are amazing, and Ironman typically produce a very consistent racing product and experience that is generally very, very good, but it doesn't mean it has to be the only option that we always default to, and it definitely doesn't mean that other events or distances are inferior and just a stepping stone not worth the same, even though they are monetarily maybe worth the same and will hurt your wallet a bit less. But for some people, choosing to race other distances and races can not only make you a better athlete, but also have more fun, have less physical and mental stress, and have a better balance of training and life as a whole. And as always, it's not an either or, you can have both. So for example, commit 12 weeks per year to focus on one Ironman race, but then the rest of the year focus on shorter distances and be a bit more relaxed about the training. The world is your oyster in terms of the options that you have available. So that's my encouragement to you, is to check the different options you have around you, try different things and find what works for you. But yeah, don't let yourself be fall into one very narrow lens of the sport by default, without thinking about all of the different options that you might have to practice the sport and practice this wonderful hobby. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. As I said at the top of the show, please let me know what you think about this format for an episode. You can, as always, find the show notes for the episode on scientifictriathlon.com. And while you're there, check out the coaching, training plan, and consultation options that we have. If you want to improve your training and performance level, then coaching is for sure the gold standard to go for. So definitely check out our options regarding coaching. But if you cannot afford coaching, which is understandably a big investment and not something that is possible for everybody, then I think that the ready-made training plans that we have is a fantastic option. Even better when you combine it with the knowledge that you gain through listening to this podcast, then you can use the plan as a starting point, but tweak it to suit your individual needs. You can find out more about all of our product and service offerings on scientifictriathlon.com, and please contact me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com if you have any particular questions. Now, finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you are looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.